Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. It's 3:06 on a Friday afternoon. We're coming to you, as usual, live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Again, as always in these Trump administration days and with our legislature in session, we have a lot to talk about. Joining me today, as he does on Mondays and Fridays, Jim Galloway, my partner from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We read him in the Thursday and Sunday hard, what do we call it?
The newspaper.
Dead tree edition.
Dead tree edition. That's my favorite phrase.
Yeah.
The dead tree edition, and you're overseeing the Political Insider blog.
It's Rise Up Friday.
Right. Oh, that's right. We got the Super Bowl Sunday. Oh, my gosh. I forgot all about that.
But Trump will do that to you.
That's funny because Trump said this morning, he bragged in a signing of an executive order, I think it was, politics is more important than the Super Bowl, they're telling me. That's a good thing. And we also have Christina Torres. It's great to have you back, Christina.
Well, thank you.
Right now covering the state Senate, your annual foray into state government politics. And we want to talk about the legislature for a while today because we've been so Trump-heavy with news lately. But before we do, Jim, can you give us a preview? You're on deadline for the Sunday column. What's the headline about what you're going to write about?
The story of the Johnson Amendment, which is sudden news.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a little while. Let me also give you a few headlines that have come to our attention throughout the morning. You probably already know by now, President Trump has ordered sanctions against Iran for a ballistic missile test that they launched earlier in the week. It is not a violation of our treaty with Iran because that applies only to nuclear weapons. So the president was well within his right to do this. But he then tweeted out, quote, Iran is playing with fire. In court today, as the government was dealing with lawsuits that relate to the travel ban, federal government acknowledged that at least 60,000 visas in the seven countries that the Trump administration has marked for special treatment have been revoked since the ban, a lot more than the 109, which Sean Spicer talked about in a press briefing the other day. The State Department today, this from Politico, said that this controversial statement, the White House issued a statement as it does annually honoring Holocaust Remembrance Day. They did not include the word Jews. That upset a lot of Jewish organizations. Politico this morning reported that, in fact, the State Department version of that message very specifically related to Jews, and the White House took it out. So it was not just an omission. It was an overt action. Finally, Kellyanne Conway, the president's senior advisor and often his spokesperson, is very hot on Twitter today because last night, talking to Chris Matthews, she referred to the Bowling Green massacre, which didn't happen, and she is getting hammered on Twitter today.
Just a nice alternate fact to lay out there, you know?
Although, to be fair, she did come back today and say that she was wrong.
Yeah, she said she used the wrong word.
Right.
What really happened, of course, is that there were two Iraqis who were deported because they were sending funding to apparently terrorist organizations. So
right, this is the incident that actually started the kind of the slowdown during the Obama administration of visas carried by people from Iraq into the U.S.
All right, all of those things are fair game for later in the show. But Christine, I want to start with you because, as I said at the very top, oh, by the way, tweet us. We always want you in the conversation at PoliticsGPB. PoliticsGPB. We have been Trump-heavy with our news, Christina, and we're about 12, 13 days into the legislative session.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Mike, let me start with this question. It feels so far like a really slow and relatively uneventful session, but I'm not down there like you are every day. Am I right about that, or are things starting to bubble up?
I think things are starting to bubble up. Keep in mind, you know, we started on January 9th. They don't meet every day. They wanted to get to the inauguration to see a Republican president and the Congress start their work. And a lot of what they're doing is waiting to see what work they're going to do. For example, the Affordable Care Act. What are they going to do with that? And I don't know that we're going to know that by the time they finish this session. It's been sort of a very quiet start. Now that we're in sort of the committee meetings have started, things have really started to pick up. You've seen votes now in both chambers. You know, the Senate passed a beer bill yesterday.
Yeah, the craft beer bill, right?
And I should probably point out they also passed something important to the governor, which is the hospital provider fee, what some people call the bed tax. Renewal was also passed. But so they're starting their work. You're going to start hearing, I think, a lot more news.
I think what one of the things that the way I might have framed that is often there are really hot issues that may not have started working their way through the legislative process quite yet, but are an undercurrent. I mean, religious liberty in past years, campus carry and other gun bills. I don't feel that there are a lot of those particularly hot issues. And again, maybe it's me and I'm just not down there.
I think they're waiting to see. I do think we're going to see, for example, a campus carry bill. Certainly those who strongly supported it, and one did pass last year, it was vetoed by the governor, say they're absolutely going to introduce something. They just haven't gotten it together yet. Religious liberty is already starting to bubble up.
Is it?
And it's hard to believe it won't bubble up a little bit more. Let's go back to before its session even started, when we had a representative file then withdraw what we call the Burka Bill, which can be put in that sort of broad pot of religious liberty. So it's there. I think they're also waiting to see what federal officials do in that kind of area.
Also, another thing, Bill, and what you've seen in other states is kind of a different tactic taken by, especially by religious conservatives, but I guess everybody else could adopt that tactic too, and that is just the lightning strike. In Ohio, it just in just a matter of days, the legislature passed a fairly strict abortion bill that I think John Kasich ended up vetoing. So I think you're going to see.
Well, North Carolina in a day
that was
passed,
24 right, hours
transgender
right.
bathroom
exactly.
bill.
And I think what you've seen over the last 4 years is that because like on religious liberty, the business community and the LGBT community have been so well coordinated that I think they're trying to keep their cards. The other side's trying to keep their cards very close to their vest.
Does it make sense that, for instance, you cite Ohio and then North Carolina? Those kind of lightning strikes are aided by the fact that you're looking at legislatures dominated by one party, in this case Republicans, so they got the power to move quickly if they want to.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Now, but in this case, as in Ohio, you have a governor who's already said that he's not going to sign this particular kind of bill or that particular kind of bill. So a lot of it is just kind of posturing for the next election year, I think.
You want to weigh in? Okay. One of the bills I wanted to focus on today, Senator Lester Jackson, a Democrat, he's introduced a new civil rights bill. Can you tell us a little bit about what this bill does?
Absolutely. Christina? It's actually going to be introduced next week.
Oh, okay.
But it's something that has been come up before. It came up last year. It obviously is going to come up this year, and it's part of that discussion that Jim was just talking about from one particular side, in this case, the Democrats, the LGBT advocates, and even some of the business community. I don't know how active they're going to be on this. And it's a statewide civil rights law, something Georgia has never had. And I think we're one of three states that does not have one. You think about these things, it what they call a public accommodation. So if you want to get a hotel rental, that you should not be discriminated against, for example, for your race or ethnicity, that type of thing. They would add sexual orientation and gender identity as well in this particular legislation.
Yeah, you could do that under state statute now. You can't do that cannot do that under federal statute.
No, and that's true, but this is a state proposal.
Exactly.
And something they want to do. There are certainly local municipalities, I believe Atlanta would be one of them, that have certain protections within, say, the city boundaries, but this would be the first statewide civil rights law in
Georgia. You have to remember that one very big object of the religious liberty legislation that has over the years, and it's had different forms, but one objective has been to put restrictions on local governments, counties, and cities to grant civil rights protection to various classes of people.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the religious liberty battle because it ties in very directly to this. Every year, as Josh McCune, senator from Columbus, has tried to advance his religious liberty bill, one of the things that the opponents have said is, Christina, you know, we don't like this bill because we think it can discriminate against various minorities, gays, lesbians, Muslims, whatever. But if we had a civil rights law in this state, at least there'd be a protection that would make us feel this really wasn't targeting us, right?
Well, the interesting thing is you certainly talk to proponents of this effort. They say, oh, it's going to protect religious faith-based folks, too. It's not just, you know, one set or another. Now, when you talk to Josh, he's very adamant. He is not anti-gay. He's not targeting a specific community like the LGBT community. He believes it's just a protection that mirrors federal law. Mm-hmm. There is a federal Religious Freedom Act out there, and it's something he believes is important. So, you know, it should be worth noting that Josh this week announced he will not run for re-election. Yeah. When he comes up next year. That very much cements his status as sort of an outside freelancer. I think Jim mentioned him, and Josh, I should tell you, was very tickled by this, the most inconvenient man at the Capitol.
Yeah. Label to give him, Jim.
He's wearing it proudly, you know, and if you want to get a sense of where he's going in terms of his role, he started periscoping Senate meetings this week, much to the chagrin and kind of pissed a few people off in terms of Republican leadership in the Senate, to the point that by the end of the week, they had announced new rules for their committees that you could not do that.
Periscoping, meaning using his phone.
I'm sorry, yes.
The app Periscope, which allows you to send video out.
Live video. Right. Let me back up. The Senate, unlike the State House in Georgia, does not broadcast live committee meetings, much to the chagrin of those who like a transparent government. Certainly the press would be among those. You have to actually go and show up at a meeting to understand what's going on.
You've
got to be in the room. And Josh has consistently filed and pressed for more transparent methods in the Senate. He has not been successful. And so, yes, he has started doing this with his phone. Now the committees are starting to pass committee rules that say that it's up to the chairman. For example, Rules Chairman Jeff Mullis has announced that you can do it from the back of the room.
You can.
But it's up to each chairman. So it's interesting to watch that come into play. And Josh, I think, is certainly still part of the religious liberty discussion, but he has not filed a bill yet. And I think he's waiting to see how things play out as well.
Well, I want to go back to the civil rights bill that Lester Jackson's going to introduce. Because, again, I'm interested in the fact that, as you pointed out, this state has never had protections for these many groups that would be included in this bill. And the same has happened with efforts to pass a hate crimes law in the state of Georgia. We're one of four states in the United States that don't have a hate crimes law. And there's a similar theme as to why neither of those has moved forward very often, Jim Galloway. And one of the most important reasons has been always that there are legislators at the Capitol who absolutely do not want to codify in any way references to gays and lesbians. They feel that is inappropriate and wrong and would open a door for some awful things to happen.
Oh, no, this is right. In addition, this Democratic bill has pretty much no chance of passing.
It's symbolic.
It's symbolic. Yes. We need to make that clear. But you have had a bipartisan push for several sessions now behind a bill that would only bar discrimination based on race, sex, or sexual orientation within state government employment.
Yes.
And that has you've had Wendell Willard and a couple other Republicans back that. That has also failed for almost identical reasons.
So this is a sort of thing that the Democrats might feel that they can use to run on in 2018, it is not going
well. And it's also about optics. They realize this is a national discussion, and certainly they want to draw national attention to Georgia, in this case, the fact that we do not have that kind of law, and the fact of what's going on here. It was made national headlines last year that we were having this big battle over religious liberty, and the bill that passed and the governor vetoed. They understand that, and that's I think, one of the reasons they're doing it.
Right, and they're, what they're doing is they're offering a bargaining chip. If you really want to pass this religious liberty bill, well, then pass this as a companion, and then we'll have a deal.
Right, and that was the point I was trying to make earlier, that the groups that feel they deserve protection are the ones who said, if you had a civil liberties law in this state, I might feel less threatened by the religious liberty bill that you're trying to pass.
So, right, and it should be noted, there's obviously a federal protection that does not include sexual orientation and gender identity, and I think that's also part of the discussion. What if we pass a civil rights law, do we take those things out? You know?
Yeah, all right. Right. So we'll watch... we'll watch and see how religious liberty moves forward. As long as we're mentioning that, and Josh McCoon, you said it, Christina, Josh automatically becomes a lame duck 2 years before. I mean, he's got this session, and presumably, is he resigning or is he serving out his term?
No, he's serving out his term.
All right, so
turn.
He's got two sessions left.
Yes.
Does he have any ability to pass a bill, given that he is no longer a player?
At this point, no.
Okay, is going to have to take up religious liberty.
Or he just hands his legislation to somebody else who puts his name on it.
Right, right.
But it's, and you know, we don't know what McCoon's going to do. He could be laying the groundwork for a statewide race for, say, attorney general or something else. We don't know.
All right. We're going to come back to this whole issue of religious liberty when we do move to the section of the show today when we'll be talking about the Trump administration, because there are some developments at the National Prayer Breakfast yesterday that relate to religious liberty. But before we go there, let's keep talking about the legislature for a while. Jim, there is legislation now. Let me set the table if I can. The state of Georgia, the legislature, in an effort to help students who want to go to private schools as a way to circumvent the direct funding of private schools, set up a scholarship fund, essentially. It's a tax credit, correct?
For about $50 million total.
And if you contribute to this fund, there are students can draw from that. They queue up to draw from that fund to help them go to private schools. It was controversial when it was passed, yes.
And it still is. And now, but now you have Republicans trying to triple it in size.
Yes, yes.
And I'd have to say, in the current climate, this stands a chance of passage, especially since you've got a budget. This has been a fiscally, it's been a good year for Georgia. Tax receipts are up, so there's a little extra money to spend.
Well, and it's also coming on the coattails of the defeat of the Opportunity School District, proposal that the governor championed so hard. And he has come back and said, I still want to find ways to help kids I believe are struggling or in schools that are struggling. And this would be one way to sell that.
One way to sell that and maybe a little bit of payback, too.
Explain that.
You had the Opportunity School District was opposed by a great many state or county school superintendents.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if you have the scholarship money going to a private school, it's not going to a public school.
So the question becomes, let's expand that. This is a moment where we should expand to what's happening in Washington. We all know that Trump's choice for education secretary, Betsy DeVos, has been a big proponent of finding ways to send students to private schools. And her nomination, Jim, now appears to be teetering on the edge. It's 50-50 right now because two Republican members of the Senate have said we are not going to vote for her.
And that could force Mike Pence to cast the deciding vote. And it's also one reason why you've seen her confirmation kind of scheduled for a floor vote before Jeff Sessions, because they still need Jeff Sessions as a Republican senator.
Yeah, to pay. That's right. Yeah. To cast that ballot.
I think it's fair to say that she's probably the weakest of Trump's cabinet choices in terms of generating support within the Congress and particularly within among Democrats.
This is, I think, Christina. When you look across the landscape of the entire country, public education, how it can be improved, how funds can be found for it, or the alternative, figuring out ways to give public school kids an opportunity to go to other schools, private schools, charter schools, whatever. I'm not sure there's any bigger issue that the country faces. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement. I think it's a perennial statement. Every year, that's always part of the discussion. I mean, charter schools are public schools, but how do you set that up? And we're talking about a little bit about the Georgia legislature. There is already a school voucher bill in the Senate. I mean, certainly it's everyone is plugged into that. With DeVos, the question becomes, okay, well then who comes up next?
Yeah. The thing here is that this is intimately connected to job creation. Because this next generation of jobs are all going to be very, very high tech, and you've got to have students who are well schooled.
I want to go back to you. Tell me about the voucher bill as opposed to the scholarship bill. What is the voucher? Help me understand the difference between these, what they do, the mechanisms.
I think the mechanism, and I'm going to be totally honest, I have not read through the entire bill, but Senator Hunter Hill coming out of South Cobb.
Buckhead, too.
And Buckhead. Both our neighborhoods. Republican.
Well, they need vouchers in Buckhead.
They might.
For those private schools. Go ahead.
But it's a little bit different that we're not setting up tax credits.
This is direct funding, right?
You're setting up a different track. You could argue they're parallel tracks, but yes. It's different than saying, hey, you get a tax credit and it goes into this pool that will run out. Once all the credits or the cap is met.
Okay.
Right. And there's just fierce competition. I think right now that currently they just come open in January
and they're gone
in seconds.
Well, which is exactly the reason that there's a proposal to increase it the pool by threefold because the money goes so quick.
And then bifurcating the offering you'd have one in January, another in July.
Okay. Let's do this. Let's take a break in a second here. There are a couple other pieces of legislation that I think are worth our talking about. Two of them involve Representative Earl Earhart, one of the great firebrands.
He's my state rep.
Well, and he's one of the great firebrands. You have a fighter in your district, Jim. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll talk about that in a minute. It's 3:28. We'll be right back.
I'm Robert Krulwich from Radiolab. We're told that smell triggers memory. So if you're in your car, you roll up your windows and inhale. What do you remember? Like the smell of a favorite dog jumping in the back seat long ago? A diaper moment, perhaps. There are some memories you cherish and others that just linger. How about contributing this barrel of aroma to your favorite public radio station? And you might even get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network of GPB. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, nationally recognized as a leader in innovative programs that help students earn their degrees.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We have with us Christina Torres and Jim Galloway from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Before we move forward, Adam Dean just tweeted us. He said, if there's a Federal Religious Liberty Act, why waste time in the state legislature with a redundant bill? Jim?
Well, because it doesn't, if you talk to supporters of it, what they say is that, yes, the federal law protects you from actions of the federal government.
Right.
But it does not protect you from the actions of the state
government. Right, but the argument that opponents use is, what Adam's saying is what they say. You've already got a federal bill. You don't need a state.
And then if you
version.
Do a civil rights, statewide civil rights law, that covers the gamut.
Right.
So absolutely. And we talked about Josh McCune. I hate to keep bringing him up because there are others. But
he loves it. You know, he tweets us all the time.
Sam Teasley, we like you too.
And Sam as well. Talking about one of his talking points is, you know, there are, for example, prisoners in the federal system that have greater protection than an average Georgian. And I think that's how he likes to talk about it, that there is a protection on one track and not the other.
Okay. Your state rep, Earl Earhart, he's been there, what, 30? Has he been as long, 25 years?
I think he's got the seniority, most seniority of any House Republican right now.
Yeah. So he's involved in two issues that I think are more than two, but two that I think are particularly interesting. One of them is he wants to limit the jurisdiction that a state university has in investigating and punishing campus sexual assaults. What is that all about?
It's a very, very delicate issue that has strong connections to Title IX and the treatment of women on public university campuses that receive federal dollars. Many universities right now, if there is a sexual assault, whether it's a date rape or a violent affair. Well, if it's a violent affair, it's one thing. But if it's you know, if it's in that gray area of date rape or something, it's something that can be adjudicated within the university system itself.
And I think that's actually a federal requirement. They have to. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of Title IX. It's not something they can voluntarily say, oh, we're going to do one or the other.
What's interesting about this, I think, is that Earhart is not proposing this because he feels that those who are victims of assaults perhaps need to have their cases heard off the university campus because perhaps the university won't take the kind of action that the victim deserves. It's the opposite.
What?
It's he believes that universities are sometimes too harsh on these what he would call questionable areas of sexual assault.
Well, what he would say is that often the rights of the accused are ignored and trampled on. And he would also say that in doing so, state universities have left themselves open to lawsuits.
Right, it's a due process issue.
Yeah.
And he has talked about, you know, being contacted, I believe, by the family of a young man who was affected by an accusation. And that's how he got interested in this, in particular with Georgia Tech, which has sort of borne the brunt of his criticism.
I would think, you know, Jim framed this correctly, is a very delicate issue. I would think this is a delicate issue for the legislators themselves. This is a tough vote to go back and explain, it seems to me, to your constituents.
It's interesting,
Christina,
because there was a hearing this week on this bill, and it's his bill. It was one of the interesting points was he's managed to get this assigned to him, and it's an appropriations track. It's not on another, you know, public safety, anything like that, higher ed.
He's chairman of the House Appropriations Subcommittee that oversees spending at universities.
So it just that raised a few eyebrows. And then at this hearing, which lasted for a while, there were a number of advocates for victims, I believe including some survivors of sexual assault who testified about their concerns of what this would do, whether, you know, you're depending who you're involving in the process and whether you felt comfortable being able to speak out on something that you say happened to you. When going back to the delicacy of the issue,
yeah, you had two young women get up and say, "We would not have reported this event if we'd known that it was going to have to go through the state legal system."
Right, right.
A distrust of what may happen in that process,
right.
And feeling more protected by the university.
It was a packed. This hearing was in one of the larger rooms of the state capitol,
sure.
And it was just filled to the brim. They were turning people away.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to watch how that develops. Earhart's involved in another one that I think is fascinating, also related to universities.
You said that so well.
And in another one in which in his role as overseeing state funding universities, back right after the Trump victory, Emory University and Agnes Scott each said they were weighing whether they wanted to become sanctuary campuses, whatever that means, by the way. There, to the best of my knowledge, there's no legal definition of what it means to be, whether it's a sanctuary school or a sanctuary city. But they both suggested they were worried about DACA, students who were given a pass by President Obama to remain here indefinitely. And so they both declared they might become sanctuary universities. This week, Claire Sturck, who, of course, is the new president at Emory, said that it's, quote, symbolically important only, essentially, and that she really didn't think it was in the best interest of the university to take this on and make some official declaration. She felt that this wasn't the way to approach it. I haven't heard from Agnes Scott.
I think it's a recognition that a lot of federal dollars are at stake. I mean, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars that go through Emory and with its research. This isn't unlike we talked about on Monday with Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed, who has put out statements not using the word sanctuary, but he says we are a welcoming city.
Yeah. Well, I should point out what Earl Earhart said in response to hearing this is, look, if they pull this, I'm not going to give them the state funds that they get for whatever they're funded for, research and other.
Right.
Well, I think that's one of the questions is how exactly would this affect a private institution? Certainly Emory, for example, does get state funding. It could be from a student who gets a Hope Scholar, scholarship or whatever, however things go. By the same token, if you're a dreamer and you're going to Emory, you're not getting state funds. It's sort of unclear how that path is going to move forward, except it gives certainly Chairman Earhart a chance to talk about this.
Well, my understanding, I think I'm right, that even after hearing President Sturck's comments, Earhart wants to press forward with this just to assure that no university tries this in the state.
Well, and we know, for example, lawmakers have pressed ahead in the past to say there are no, you can't be a sanctuary city in Georgia, right?
What you have to remember is that there is always this tension between the state legislature and the Board of Regents.
Sure.
Because the Board of Regents has this high degree of independence in how they spend their money. And it's written into the Constitution. We could go back to the 1940s, and I could give you a little history lesson, but we don't want to do that right now.
No,
but it's always there. The legislature is always trying to put strings on what university officials do.
Well, the most dramatic way in which that was manifested was over campus carry. Legislature passes campus carry against the express concern and lobbying of the Board of Regents is that we don't want to have anything to do with campus carry.
Right. And so, you talk about sanctuary campuses, which in this case with Chairman Earhart, those are private institutions.
Yeah.
It's not something he's doing with the state institutions. You flip that to campus carry, which is explicitly about what can happen on a state-run, state-funded university or college. And it gets to Jim's point about being able to control what the regents may or may not be able to do, what type of political power they may still have. They're getting a new chancellor with Chancellor Wright. And the question is whether he still has the ear of Governor Deal and whether the governor may be willing to block the similar type of legislation in a very, very Second Amendment happy General Assembly.
Yeah. By the way, Jim, just as an aside, I know when you and I are really getting old because we both remember when Steve Wright was just a young guy working for Zell Miller, and now he's going to be
old chancellor now.
No.
Congratulations to him. He was always a fascinating guy to work with, and I'm sure he'll continue to be. A couple other quick things we're going to keep our eye on and certainly talk about as we move forward in the legislative session. It appears that the legislators really are making some progress in looking at a statewide approach to mass transit.
Right, right. You've got a House study bill going on. You've got a Senate study bill. I think one is it that the Senate bill would, the House bill would mandate a report out by the end of this year.
Mm-hmm.
which would allow, if there's a ballot issue involved, it would allow for the legislature to put it on in November 2018. The Senate bill would not.
The Senate bill would actually require a report, I believe, by the end of 2018, even end of 2019. It certainly draws that out much further. I think to me, the interesting thing, they're finally talking about regional transit. By the same token, there's nothing that's going to happen quickly.
Right.
Even if they get a report out by the end of this year, there's no guarantees of what may happen.
Right. No, because there's money involved. There's control of MARTA involved. There's a long path of negotiation that has to be taken.
All right, but it's a real sea change when the state of Georgia starts really looking seriously about transit.
That's probably the biggest and most abrupt change that I think I've witnessed in the Capitol.
Absolutely, absolutely. One last quick note about Georgia politics. Greg Bluestein reported this week, your colleague, that we've got the first hints of someone beginning to talk about running for governor. And it's about time for that. By the time the session ends, I suspect we'll be hearing about more candidates talking about it. But who's the first one who's sort of hinting
this was,
at it?
This was Brian Kemp, and it was something of a
Secretary of State.
A little bit of a surprise. It was just a single line in a speech that he gave to a business group that he says he wants to make this unique expertise that he has available to the state over in the coming decade.
Well, we'll watch him.
That's a very soft rollout, but it's still a rollout.
Well, and there may be more coming. Of course, he's doing this as a presumptive front runner. Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle is taking a noticeable role in presiding over the Senate. It's always interesting to watch the optics. Let's see how Lieutenant Governor responds.
All right. We're eager for a governor's race.
What you want to look for is you want to watch what happens to Secretary of State Brian Kemp's budget as it rolls through because there's a really good chance that the Senate might just have a few things to
cut
say about
it down a little bit. By the way, Senator Nan Orrick, our good friend, pointed out that I had a senior moment. I called him Steve Wright. Of course, the new chancellor is Steve Wrigley. I knew that. I'm just, like I said, I'm getting old.
But that may have been my mistake.
No, it was me. Tell you what we're going to do. We have a lot of Trump news to talk about, but why not just have a clean break from all this state conversation? Come back with the latest on Donald Trump. Let's take our break right now at 3:42 and come back and talk about national politics.
Atlanta business owners offer mixed reviews of President Donald Trump's first few days in office.
I think, you know, he's a radical reformer. I think we need major change.
I'm worried about his orders and ideas and things that he's implementing, his attitude.
I'm Audie Cornish, expectations of the new president from a key economic hub of the South. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 till 7 right here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. I'm joined by my AGAC friends, Jim Galloway and Christina Torres. Jim writes oversees the Political Insider blog, which Christina often contributes to and appears in the paper on Thursdays and Sundays. And Christina's covering right now the state Senate, covers politics year round. By the way, tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Our friend Thought Crime, who often has all sorts of things to say critically about what we're doing, says, great discussion. Any updates on the Mitchell case? He's talking about the City of Atlanta corruption case. Wow, that has the potential to get hot.
Yeah, and you've seen a few. It might be related to about $7 million in emergency contracts given to the E.R. Mitchell Company.
Yeah.
I think weather-related contracts, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Storm cleanup, I believe.
Which presumably are then retroactively assessed to make sure the contracts were not excessive in terms of the amount of money. We're not sure if that happened. More important, we don't know who else is going to get caught up in this thing, and that's got City Hall on tenterhooks, I think it's fair to say.
Well, and it's coming as you have a mayor's race shaping up.
Exactly.
Right.
Catherine Cummings has a tweet that I do think we should address because I know how sensitive we all are to that whole issue of whatever it's called, date rape. She says, gray area of date rape, rape is rape, and all kinds are violent and criminal. And her point is well made. The problem is it is very difficult to figure out how to talk, what language to use when you talk about a couple in which the man usually says, she didn't stop me, and the woman says, of course I didn't want him. And that it is a very tricky
right,
area.
And the key problem is that usually you're dealing with two individuals,
yeah,
and no one else, no witnesses.
Yeah. Yeah, but I know when you said gray area, you weren't in any way making downgrading the significance of somebody.
No,
who's
no.
No, and I think that gets to many advocates for assault victims, their fears, because it is so hard to talk about. And because it often comes down to, for lack of a better way to put it, he said, she said,
exactly.
Depending on the circumstances, that's what makes it so hard. And again, if you involve law enforcement as a mandate, that's their concern.
Yeah. All right. Let's move to Trump. Yesterday, the National Prayer Breakfast, we have a couple of we do want to play some sound from the National Prayer Breakfast. Let's take the most substantive of the things he talked about yesterday. And this relates back to our discussion about religious liberty here in Georgia. The president, for the first time yesterday, made it clear that he may be looking at some new religious liberty proposals that could have a big impact across the country and here in Georgia.
Among those freedoms is the right to worship according to our own beliefs. That is why I will get rid of and totally destroy the Johnson Amendment and allow our representatives of faith to speak freely and without fear of retribution. I will do that. Remember.
Jim, what's the Johnson Amendment? You wrote about it, and you're writing about it for this week's column.
Right, right. Well, back in 1954, it was a little amendment to the tax code that Lyndon Johnson, he was still a U.S. senator from Texas, placed in there. It was not aimed at churches. It was aimed at non-profit charitable institutions. This one in particular was something called Fax Focus. It was an H.L. Hunt. The Texas oilman was backing it with millions of dollars. It was a kind of a McCarthyite anti-communist organization. Johnson feared that it was going to be turned on him, and so he slipped that in. But it was again no churches were targeted. They're the collateral damage. According to the tax code, 501c3 organizations cannot endorse specific political candidates. They can embrace political causes, but not candidates. And that's what the religious conservatives right now want removed.
Although I do believe, and you can look at the national reports to say whether I'm right or wrong, the IRS does not often go after churches.
That's very absolutely right. Right. Well, very look at right. How often where, especially the Democratic candidates, do all their Sunday campaigning
right.
in churches across the state.
And even critics of even the people who want it removed, the Johnson Amendment removed, agree that the IRS just, once in a blue moon, it might enforce
and
this.
And they always get pushback.
But here's the thing. What would happen is if the people who don't want this removed, what they're fearful of is that a church could become highly politicized and contributions could start flowing to that church on that basis. And for the first time, that would make a political contribution tax deductible.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it is a despite the IRS's reluctance to go after these things, it does suggest some potential issues like you're pointing out. But there's a couple of things we should also point out here. One is that, the president has been issuing all these executive orders, and it's very dramatic and bold. But there are any number of them that need following up by Congress or whatever, that he really can't do anything about other than to make a bold statement.
And this is a prime example.
And this is
a
great example.
You cannot just randomly cross
right.
out the Johnson
No,
Amendment.
He can,
he needs
I mean,
Congress.
He can, the only thing he could do in this case is probably is tell the IRS
not to
enforce
it. But they're
this.
Not doing it anyway.
Exactly.
The other reason that this becomes interesting to watch is that it might be the beginning of an ongoing campaign of religious liberty. I mean, there are those who think that President Trump may, in fact, look at legislation, maybe you'll start it with an executive order that really would give employers right. the right,
right
to fire on the basis of religious people.
There is a draft executive order that's floating around Washington, and I've read it, and it could have been written within the Georgia State Legislature, and it would give those with strong religious beliefs and businesses based on those beliefs whether they have anything to do with the practice of religion or not, a pass when it comes to discriminating according to their view of marriage, on issues involving transgenders. They don't include race, the protections against race. Racial discrimination.
But that again goes back to our discussion about the civil rights bill. You know, there's certain things that are protected. He can't randomly cross out.
And you had Steve Spicer, Sean Spicer, we've got Steve on the brain here. The White House spokesman kind of alluding to the need to give businesses protections on this. And this is, you know, a lot of this is kind of drawn from the Hobby Lobby case.
That's exactly right. The Hobby Lobby case, again, being the case in which this company sued because it felt it was violation of their religious principles to, under Obamacare, have to provide contraceptive services as part of their health care plan.
Well, contraceptives, yeah.
Yeah, contraceptives, I'm sorry. All right, well, Donald Trump made other news at the National Prayer Breakfast. He got up in that, you know, it reminded me a little bit of the event that he and Hillary Clinton went to during the campaign when they do the big Catholic Charities event in New York, and Trump didn't quite find the right tone at that event in terms of, it's supposed to be a roast, but he took it a little far. Yesterday at the National Prayer Breakfast, he didn't take it as far as he did at Catholic Charities, but he did go after his good friend, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
But we had tremendous success on The Apprentice. And when I ran for president, I had to leave the show. That's when I knew for sure I was doing it. And they hired a big, big movie star, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to take my place. And we know how that turned out. The ratings went right down the tubes. It's been a total disaster. And Mark will never, ever bet against Trump again. And I want to just pray for Arnold, if we can, for those ratings, okay?
Hey, Donald, I have a great idea. Why don't we switch jobs? You take over TV, because he's such an expert in ratings, and I take over your job, and then people can finally sleep comfortably again.
I don't think we need to introduce Arnold Schwarzenegger, who followed the Trump comment. You know, Jim, this is the kind of thing that people who think Trump is going to be a great president or a good president just wish he'd stop doing.
Right, but I'll tell you, you know, this is, I mean, we know that Trump is not just president. He is a CEO of many a corporation, chief stakeholder. And you got to remember, I mean, with that prayer for Arnold might have been quite sincere, because I've been reading that he's still listed as an executive producer.
Oh, he is definitely
an executive producer. Which is supposedly is worth something like $7 million a year to him.
Okay.
How do you follow that?
Christina is just speechless, yeah.
But I make a point. It really is. There, again, the people, even the people who think Trump, I mean, clearly this is great fodder for the Trump critics, but even those who think he's going to be wonderful wish he'd sort of rein this kind of thing in.
Bernie Sanders just tweeted, "Congratulations to President Trump on his deep spiritual awakening at the National Prayer Breakfast."
I want to point out, we mentioned at the top the Iran sanctions. Both David Perdue and Johnny Isaacson, our U.S. senator, sent out a statement applauding the Trump administration's sanctions against Iran. We must continue to send a strong message to Iran's leaders. We will not tolerate any kind of destabilizing activity, from sponsoring terrorist groups to continued testing of ballistic missiles. You know, Jim, at the same time that he's critical of Iran, he also sent a message, a strong message to Israel this week. I think most people assume that with Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, an Orthodox Jew, advising him, among others, that he would be very, very sympathetic to whatever Benjamin Netanyahu does. And the other day, he said to Israel, slow down on your expansion of settlements. It doesn't help the peace process. And he said, the White House said, they do still believe in a two-state solution.
Right. And this comes, I mean, if you'll remember, right after the inauguration, that's when Israel announced that it was going to make a new push for, what, 2,500 more?
Well, they've done it. They've expanded by 2,500.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And now this is kind of, you have to wonder if some of this may be the result of a State Department head coming online and finally some relatively deep thinkers on the topic are finally making they're making their opinions known.
We're going to watch that with great interest. Real quick note, Jim, you set out a little item that you posted on Political Insider. It's not the Falcons versus the Patriots. It's John Lewis's team versus Donald Trump's. Explain real quickly.
Okay, all right. The Falcons are in Atlanta, of course. That's the 5th District. Arthur Blank, the owner, has kind of criticized Trump on that Holocaust message. Whereas on the Patriots, the owner, the coach, and Tom Brady are both big fans of Donald Trump.
All right. Super Bowl Sunday. I guess we'll all be watching.
Yeah. Rise up, right?
All right. Before we close the show today, we've only got a couple minutes left. There's a picture that opened across the country, including in Atlanta today, called I Am Not Your Negro. It's a documentary about James Baldwin, the great novelist, poet, essayist, social critic. Powerful, I'm told, by people who've seen it, is that this is not about James Baldwin. This is of James Baldwin. The entire documentary is his own words. Samuel Jackson reading some, Baldwin himself in others. And I thought it'd be interesting to listen. Last fall, we did a two-way street about Studs Terkel, the great Chicago radio interviewer, the author. And when we did that show, we pulled some of his most famous interviews, and one of them was with James Baldwin. And I thought it would be worth listening today, kind of in honor of this documentary coming out, what James Baldwin told Studs Terkel. It's really powerful stuff.
One's born in a white country, in a white Protestant Puritan country, where one was once a slave, where all the standards and all the images that you open your, when you open your eyes in the world, everything you see, none of it applies to you. You go to white movies, and you know, and like everybody else, you fall in love with Joan Crawford, and you root for the good guys who are killing off the Indians. And it comes as a great psychological collision when you begin to realize that all of these things are really metaphors for your oppression, and will lead into a kind of psychological warfare in which you may perish. I obviously wasn't white. It wasn't even a question so much of wanting to be white. But I didn't quite know anymore what being black meant. I couldn't accept what I'd been told, and all you ever told in this country about being black is that it's a terrible, terrible thing to be. Now, in order to survive this, you have to really dig down into yourself and recreate yourself, really, according to no image which yet exists in America. You know, you have to impose, in fact, this may sound very strange, you have to decide who you are, and force the world to deal with you and not this idea of you.
It's James Baldwin. We have about 20 seconds or so. Your quick reflections on that, Jim.
Which is one of the great thinkers of the 20th century.
And yeah. Christina, he's talking about something that remains in this country all these years later in 2017, an issue.
Of course. What is your American identity?
Yeah. Christina Torres, Jim Galloway, thank you for being here. Go see this James Baldwin movie. It's a perfect time to see it. It's really kind of an honor to be able to present his words as we end the show today. I'm Bill Nygut. We'll be back with another Political Rewind on Monday at 2 o'clock. In the meantime, have a terrific Super Bowl weekend. See you Monday.